Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Faith Radio Mornings here on the 10th of January. This is hour two of our show, and because it's a Thursday morning, it means that my good friend and professor of Christian theology, Jim Bilby, is joining us, and we have our Ask Anything segment in which we invite you as listeners to text or call in with any question you have about the faith, about the Bible, about parenting, anything along those lines. We're happy to give it a whack. Whether we're right or wrong, we'll definitely still engage with those topics, and you can do so at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-FAITH. And Jim, as always, good to see you back in the rhythm here for class right now, I assume, as school's gotten started again.
Well, back in the rhythm would be probably overstating a little bit.
Yeah.
The rhythm, it feels like it's more attacking me rather than me attacking it. But yeah, I'm back. We're back at it. We're trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, long January classes tend to be long. And January tends to be dark. It's a tough time a little bit, but we're going to muddle through.
Yeah, it is. And you're teaching a three-hour-a-day course or 2 hours, 45 minutes, something like that. And things have really shifted, haven't they, over the last 15 years? It's pretty tough with today's attention span, understandably so, for any of us, myself included, to be engaged in two-and-a-half, three-hour classes.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a difficult thing. I think there has been a shift in attention span. How this generation receives information is in, you know, 3 second bites, you know, a lot of visuals and sort of thing. But, you know, I think it's still possible. It's just, it's difficult. It's more difficult. You have to try to do, you got to try to do some different stuff.
Well, as part of our Ask Anything segment, as we get started here, I need to ask you a question, and it has to do with the fact is why don't doctorates and postgraduate degrees relate to anything about common sense in life at all? Because I'm sitting in front of you here this morning, and you and I both have our doctorates, and yet I have what appears to be a broken nose at this point from running the recycle bin down to the bottom of the driveway on a Tuesday when it was so windy, and the wind caught the lid of the recycle bin, flipped it up in my face, and I went down. I thought I was done. You know me, I'm a bit of a diva, so any kind of pain like that, I assume my life has ended. But we do. Why isn't the doctorate helpful for common sense at all, Jim? Or is this a me problem, not a doctorate problem?
Well, I would actually get no more joy than to say I think it's just a you problem. I do actually think there is an interesting sort of fact about people with you know, higher degrees that seems like get really, really clear on little things, but a lot less clear on the big things.
Yeah.
Actually, there's an old saying about a person with a PhD, right?
What's that?
A person with a PhD is a person who learns more and more about less and less until they know all there is to know about nothing at all.
That is, unfortunately, a terribly true comment in my experience, Jim.
So, of the various things that you know, all sorts of things about avoiding wind, wind-driven objects is not one of them.
Yeah,
right?
Well, certainly I was in with the doctor yesterday, and I was hopeful that I wasn't going to get black and blue under my eyes because it had been 24 hours. And she said, no, that kind of thing can emerge within about 3-4 days. So maybe this time next week I look a bit like a raccoon in front of you.
Actually, that would bring me great joy.
I'm sure it would. That's Jim Bilby, who joins us here on Thursday mornings for our Ask Anything segment. If you want to join the show with any kind of question, please feel free to text or call at 877-93-FAITH. And our first question came from a listener last week, and we'll address this after the break. And it has to do, Jim, with what it means that God numbers our days. So more to come here on Faith Radio Mornings. Past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and that is the music Jim Bilby has chosen as his walk-up music to introduce our Ask Anything segment that we do every Thursday morning here. And Jim, I know a listener called in last week and asked the question about what it means that God numbers our days. I'm curious, any kind of response? I got to admit, I'm drawing a blank on this one. I don't really understand whether God really does just have maybe 15 days outlined for me or 3,000 or what that looks like, but there's a lot of implications to this question.
Yeah, so the idea of numbering our days comes from Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is this passage that talks about the greatness of God in all these ways. So there's a, it's the passage that people refer to talk about God's omnipresence. Where, you know, where, wherever, you know, the highest mountain, you are there, and the deepest valley, Lord, you are there. And so there's all these just like, you could say compliments to God. And one of the things that's said there in Psalm 139:16, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Right. So the days were numbered is the phrase that sometimes use. So I think what it does is articulates this great truth about God is that he knows what the future. He knows what's going to happen. Right. So there's this awareness. Things don't surprise God is an easy way of saying this. Right. Now, some people, and here's where we get like, so I'd say it's important to like realize that's the kind of core truth. Now, what are the differences of opinion you can have about that? So some people will say he knows it, but we're still free to choose what we're doing. He just knows what we're going to choose. Others want to take that. No, the days are numbered means he has decided every event of our life and he's ordained, you know, so it's like a blueprint that's laid out in front of us. Now, I have some opinions on that. I tend to side with the first opinion quite a bit, and that has everything to do with the question, the problem of evil.
Right.
Right. If we're talking about God ordaining, you know, well, I got this great job, and I, you know, married this great woman, and, you know, I have these great kids, then we're all, like, happy about God's ordaining. But when we start talking about things like broken noses and, let's be honest, far more serious things, then the question of God's ordaining things that are seem pretty overtly evil, like the Holocaust or, you know, childhood cancer or something like that, that seems a little more difficult. So that's the debate. The question is, when we think about God's days being, or God numbering our days, is that just a function of him knowing what's going to happen, or is it a function of him deciding what's going to happen?
Well, and with that question, it seems interesting to me how often our conversations on Thursday mornings tips into this question of who has what amount of agency. How much agency does God have in terms of his power and sovereignty? How much agency do we have to affect the future in some way, shape, or form? And this number of our days question calls to mind the Hezekiah story in the text, in which God basically tells Hezekiah through the prophet Isaiah to get his affairs in order. He is going to die shortly. And Hezekiah says, hang on just a minute. God, I've been a pretty faithful king here, and I think I could use a little bit more time ruling Israel. And sure enough, God comes back and grants him more time. And some people would suggest, well, God knew it all along, and so it was just sort of this invitation to Hezekiah to lean into God more so. Or is it possible to actually change future outcomes as we then interact with God? And if that's the case, now that opens up a whole other case of can of worms.
So that raises even another question. So again, there's two broad ways of thinking about it. God ordains everything down to the smallest deal or degree. He doesn't ordain everything, but he knows it. That Hezekiah passage, I think it's Isaiah 38, is raising the question of, well, maybe if God changed his mind, he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen. He's,
right,
in a sense, making it up as he goes along. The comeback to that is that there are a number of places in Scripture where I think God is like, seeming like he's changing his mind, but that's because he's reacting to us in relationship in the moment, right? And so when it seems like God is regretting what's happening or God is changing his mind, it's not as much a function of his not knowing what's going to happen, but just being a relational God, right? So, you know, a great example that's sometimes used is when God is in engaging or in having Moses engage with the Pharaoh.
Right.
And he's basically saying, hey, you know, don't worry. In Exodus 4, he talks, there's language like, well, if Pharaoh does this, we can do this. And if Pharaoh does something else, we have a different plan. So he's talking about a plan B. And some people go, well, that means that God doesn't know what's going to happen. No, what he's doing there is he's giving Moses, who's kind of a scared person, confidence that whatever happens, we've got this. So he's engaging him relationally with what he needs at that moment to get him through that day. So I think it's plausible, at least. At least I'm willing to take the stance that God absolutely foreknows these things, even when in Scripture it seems like he's regretting or changing his mind or something like that. That doesn't change the fact that he still knows what's going to happen. The harder debate is this idea of ordaining everything down to the smallest degree. And undoubtedly, God accomplishes his plans, but does that require that everything that you've done, that shirt right there,
right,
is chosen by God. Right. And that, and of course, this is the heart of what's sometimes called the Calvinist Arminian debate on providence.
Yeah, of course it is.
And it's a huge, it is a genuine, really important question for Christians.
Yeah, it really is. And you make a point when we think about God's plan for our lives, and I talk with students about this quite often, it tends to relate to the big things that God has a plan for us if we're going to get married, if God's going to have a plan about a job or our health or something. But if we take it down to this sort of micro detail level, and right now I'm pounding the studio desk and then I'm sort of choosing to not pound or pound, is God ordaining, even in this moment, the silly example where I think I have some agency to be pounding the desk or not, and yet did God ordain all of this?
Right, and so and that raises another really important issue. We often think that, oh, well, yeah, God ordains the big things.
Right.
And by those things, we think the things that are really important, like what job I'm going to get or something like that. And you know what? I kind of think, again, thinking from an Arminian perspective, where God does ordain some things and maybe not everything, that God is far more concerned about some of the, what we consider to be the little things.
Yeah.
And less concerned about the job. So like, I can imagine, oh God, what job? I mean, that's like what you have for me, right? And I can imagine God saying, well, I don't care what job you do, just do it all to my glory. And then the things that we think are little about how we interact with people, that might be some far more important things. So what we consider to be the big things, the really important things, are oftentimes not necessarily the things that God's like most on his list about the things that are that the we have to get that figured out, right?
Certainly.
That you have a job is a pretty big deal. What exactly that job is, that's probably less important in terms of God's plan than how you do that job every single day.
That's why I said, Jim Bilby, if you want to join the program this morning with any kind of question, you can certainly text or call the studio at 877-933-2484. And Jim, before we had to break, one more thought on this topic, and that relates to is some of the problem and the reason why it's so hard to resolve this dilemma is we're talking about humans confined to time and space and sequence, and we're sort of experiencing things sequentially as cause and effect, and yet God is living within this eternal sphere, and so there's some dimension of God that is outside the time that we're always experiencing. I don't know how to think about it, but is that part of the problem?
I think it clearly is, although that gets really complicated really quickly. When first, just the idea, can God be outside of time?
Right.
Time, it doesn't, like a room you step into and outside of, the idea of being outside of time, I'm actually not entirely sure what that means. Probably a better way of thinking about it is that when God experiences events, he doesn't experience them like we do, sequentially. You know, he experiences them all together.
Mm.
So that raises all sorts of interesting questions about how we relate to a God that would experience in that particular way.
Yeah, well, certainly in 8 minutes we can engage the topic, but it seems to escape a final resolution for the two of us and for just about anybody who's really thought about it. It's one of those troubling questions.
That's really surprising, though, don't you think? I'd have thought in 8 minutes we could have knocked this one out.
Yeah, for a guy that got his nose broken by a recycle bin, I'm really surprised I couldn't sort it out as well. We'll take a short break here, Jim, and when we come back, we'll change the topic to ideas of worship and how we understand really truly entering into the worship of God. Love it when Rachel Sutton resurrects that old song, and it was representative of my segment with good friend Bill Arnold, who's our afternoon show host now here on the Faith Radio Network. Always so much fun to do something along the lines of Ask Anything, in which we just banter back and forth about the topics of the day. And Jim, I know one of the things you and I talked about off air is a bit about this idea of worship. And over the holidays, we had a chance to be a part of a scriptural study, an all-day scriptural study, with a group of people that are involved in the local worship scene in the Twin Cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And we talked quite a bit about the idea of worship being something that we obviously do it through music, but what the tension is between trying to put on really good music, almost concert level music that's dialed down to the last moment and you've got to make the perfect drum transitions and all of those sorts of things with what really the heart of worship is. How do we understand the interaction of really professionally done music with worship and the importance or lack thereof of it?
Well, I'm going to preface my comment by, you know, that sometimes things need to have warning labels. What I'm going to say should maybe have a controversial warning label here.
Yep.
And I think I want to even question the premise of the question you raised there. Sort of assume that worship had to be musical.
Hmm.
Notice in our society, when we think of worship, we almost equate worship and music. Why is that?
Yeah, I realized even as I was asking the question, that's exactly what I was doing.
So here's a question. I have absolutely no doubt that a powerful form of worship is music. And there are people that dedicate their lives to, you know, creating these amazing worship experiences. And so that's great. And I don't want to downplay that at all. But what I do want us to think about a little bit is a broader definition of worship, right? So think of what worship is anything that calls attention to the lordship of Jesus Christ, or calls attention, brings your attention to something that is true about God that you acknowledge gleefully, right? So, but for me personally, worship music just doesn't do it, right? Now, I don't mean there's no music that causes me to worship. There are songs that are, you know, really even profoundly emotional for me with respect to, you know, just bringing my awareness to God. But interestingly, those are almost all ones that have some pretty deep theology that are articulating ideas and concepts that my mind is grabbing onto. So that says something about how I'm wired. There are some people who just, you know, the music themselves is spectacular, and that pulls them into this worshipful mood where they're seeing something that's true about God. For me, that's not the case at all. And so, like, you know, there's a song called In Christ Alone. Actually, ironically, it's the theology in it I don't even agree with completely. I would critique gently certain aspects of that theology. But what it is, it's this incredibly powerful, theologically meaty song, and the words in there cause me to reflect on God in ways that it's profoundly worshipful for me. But I would say, if you're talking about the number of songs, and especially praise songs out there that cause me to do that, it's about 1 in 100 million. Right. And so for me, as how I'm wired, and here's the deal, I bet there are a lot of other people for whom this is the case as well. Worship music isn't our primary way of being ushered into God's presence. For me, a walk through the woods is far more worshipful than worship music. For me, reflecting and thinking about God's nature, and even teaching about God's nature, is a far more worshipful experience. And what I worry about is that our churches, when we define worship so narrowly, we're leaving an entire segment of people out in the dark or without meaningful experiences of worship. So I think we do need to have all those conversations about how do we worship through music, and that's absolutely great. What I really hope that we do is start to broaden our definition of what worship is.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we need to sort of unwed the synonyms that we've made between music and worship as being the same thing, as opposed to the idea that music is one form of worship in which we may or may not engage, but that our whole life could actually be worship. And you reference walking in the woods. I remember a couple of years ago starting out a journey into the Highlands of Scotland at about 6 o'clock in the morning. And by the time it was maybe 8:30 and the sun was coming up, we were in the top of the Highlands and there was nothing around us but just this beauty and wonder. I can't think of a time other than that evoked that sense of, boy, God, you are creator, I am creature, I am so grateful for who you are.
Yeah, exactly. So what we need to do, and here's the other disadvantage of wedding music and worship, is that oftentimes life is so crazy that it's difficult to get your worship on if it's all just about music.
Right.
But if we think about worship in a broader sense, it's possible to worship throughout your entire day. Worship without ceasing, you know, the pray without ceasing.
Right.
It's possible to worship without ceasing, but only if we have a broader definition of what worship is.
And it seems like an invitation to start our day that way. I know for me, this sort of invitation to start with a quiet time of some kind almost took on this negative connotation because it felt like I was being beaten over the head. You must start your day this way. But there is a sense in which, as we're rightly ordered with God, to start our day with some form of anchoring, some form of, whether it is a prayer, maybe a Benedictine kind of prayer, whether it's a music song, whether it's reading the text, whether it's sitting watching the sunrise, just something that gets us started that way really can start the trajectory of our day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's real benefit in having those sort of rhythms of life. But my point is that people are going to be very different in terms of what that actually looks like for them. And so instead of trying to be, and I, for many years, I tried to be the Christian that everybody else was.
Right.
And I was terrible at it.
Yeah, me too.
And so I kind of had this thought, well, maybe I just might be just a really bad Christian. Instead, what I've realized is that I'm just different. I'm wired different. And therefore, my Christianity and the way I live out my faith is going to be different than other people. And to give the people that permission is such a big deal. So important.
It really is. Well, I see we have a question that can get us set up already for next week as we revisit this segment. We've got an email. It says, can God be addressed as Yahweh Jireh or Yahweh Shalom instead of Jehovah Shalom? Yahweh versus Jehovah. How do we understand the names of God, especially as we see them in the Old Testament? So it looks like we've already got a good one for next week, Jim.
All right. We'll dive into that.
And in the meantime, I'm going to pray for your Christian sense of sympathy since you seem to be laughing at my raccoon-like features from my broken nose.
Well, they're not raccoon-like, but I promise you when they are raccoon-like, I will laugh at them with the Lord's joy.
Always great to see you, Jim. We're going to head into break with the song you referenced that I really love, too. It's In Christ Alone.
In Christ alone, my hope is found. He is my light, my strength, my song.
Well, there's always so much in the news that I find terribly difficult to believe that actually happened, but apparently a Maryland man used numbers from a dream to win a lottery jackpot. But it's not the first time. It's the second time he has scored a lottery jackpot with numbers he got from a dream. Richard Joyner said he dreamt the numbers 4, 8, 5, and 6 and decided to use them in a virtual horse racing lottery game. They ended up scoring him a jackpot of over 15 grand, and if that's not good enough for him, it's the second time he used a dream to his advantage. Last year, he earned a nearly $40,000 lottery win with numbers that came to him in his sleep. Maybe I'm not sleeping long enough at night to get these kind of dreams. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Pastor Kevin Smith, and he was a lot of fun, and he was talking about the difference between forgiveness and reconciliation and why that matters.
Forgiveness and reconciliation are related, but not the same. Forgiveness, we must forgive one another. We release the person from debt, as it were. Because bitterness destroys us internally, right? But reconciliation goes a step further. Reconciliation can only take place when both sides of the equation come to the table and admit their own stuff. And then we can be reconciled. But until that happens, we can't. And see, why are we having this discussion continually, Peter? Why does it keep coming up? I submit to you, as someone once said, that racism is America's original sin. It's in our DNA. And it will not go away, I believe, until Jesus comes. I really believe we're going to have this conversation because our nation was founded on it.
First time I had a chance to speak with Pastor Smith, and the time was all too short. It was just a wonderful conversation filled with a lot of insight and just accessible wisdom related to conversations on reconciliation and justice in our country. And if you want to catch that entire segment, you go to myfaithradio.com, search for yesterday's show, Kevin Smith, hear all of what he had to say. Well, we've already been chatting with Kim Cotola, one of our favorites here on Faith Radio Mornings, just off air. And when we come back after a short break, Kim and I are going to talk about the current shape of the abortion conversation, the pro-choice, the pro-life conversation, and we see some pretty interesting admissions coming out of Planned Parenthood recently.
What do you do when you find out your teen's been lying to you? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Some parents grossly overreact, and others are convinced their kid will just grow out of it. Both responses to lying completely miss the mark. If you find that your teen has lied to you or someone else, I'd suggest several steps. First, describe the dishonest behavior so you both know and admit it happened. Second, tell your child how you feel about it and how your values prohibit it. Third, and most important, affirm that you know your child can do better. Mom and Dad, you can give your child confidence to do what's right. Don't let those little lies slide by. When dishonesty shows up in your home, confront it.
Find books and other resources online at ParentingTodaysTeens.org. That's parentingtodaysteens.org.
About 19 minutes before the top of the hour, and delighted to be joined by the familiar voice of Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Ministry, Cradle My Heart Radio. Kim, it's always great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to talk with you, too.
So pretty interesting. You sent me a number of different possible headlines here. I don't know if we can get to all of them, but let's dive in on some of these topics. Interesting information coming out of Planned Parenthood, where the head of Planned Parenthood kind of was maybe a bit too honest in some of the company's goals and achievements.
Well, so Dr. Leanna Wen took the reins from Cecile Richards. And I mean, I think that, you know, if we're looking at their strategy to put a doctor in charge, certainly signals that, okay, we're a healthcare organization, where Cecile Richards was a political operative. That was always her expertise. But she was covered in by BuzzFeed. There have been a lot of flattering pieces that have come out about her since she was named the president. But BuzzFeed published a lengthy look at her strategy for Planned Parenthood, reporting on a tour that she was going for, looking for ways to provide more routine health care services to women. By the way, they say now we're offering hormone therapy, Peter, which doesn't mean menopausal women can go there for their estrogen. It means transgender people can go there for their transition. Anyway, I mean, that's their next big push, although I think it's probably not going to be as lucrative as abortion because there are just fewer people interested in those services. But anyway, she says she told BuzzFeed people aren't coming to Planned Parenthood to make a political statement. And they quoted her accurately in talking about how important abortion is to what people are coming to Planned Parenthood for. And then she had to turn around and do damage control and said, you know, the headlines misconstrue her vision for Planned Parenthood. Our core mission, she's quoted as saying, she tweeted, is providing, protecting, and expanding access to abortion and reproductive health care.
It's a phenomenal admission. So, where did she go from there, from that part of it?
Well, she's just saying, you know, so then she also went from there to talking about how, although pro-life forces have politicized the issue, she went on to talk about how Planned Parenthood is a powerful political force. And she said, she told CBS that she's a physician with no interest in politics. Planned Parenthood business is providing health care, not stirring up political controversy. However, she's talking about, you know, what happened in the 2018 midterms, including the record number of women, historic pro-reproductive health majority elected to the House, proving that Planned Parenthood continues to be a powerful political force across the country. Why is that? Because, of course, they paid money to get many of those elections across the finish line. And she noted serving patients must include fighting abortion restrictions in legislatures and at the ballot box. And so I think it's actually kind of refreshing that she's being honest about this, but she has really strayed from the talking points and not happy about the fact that it's being reported accurately.
And you referenced, Kim, some of the hormonal therapy and some of the gender conversations, too. I know we were joined by Brandon Showalter of the Christian Post earlier this week that does quite a bit of writing on gender and hormonal therapy and all of these ideas. Boy, it certainly is the rippling impact when we begin to change what our ideologies are in terms of masculinity, femininity, of life, of what it means to grow and change and all of that. Boy, there's a lot of tricky conversations going on right now, aren't there?
And we need to understand, Peter, that if you oppose this, you need to oppose Planned Parenthood. This is, again, a top agenda item for them. So one of the items we might want to discuss in more detail is this Say Abortion campaign being spearheaded by Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, which also has a doctor as their executive director. And when you go to their page, by the way, the thing is not getting any traction on Twitter, where they have a hashtag say abortion. They're hoping to, you know, destigmatize by having people tell their stories unapologetically. But if you go to the campaign page, you see three stories of women who've had abortions. One of them at Planned Parenthood. One of them is a, an employee of Planned Parenthood. I mean, it's not your average woman on the street that they're getting to tell their story. And then right below it, you see gender and abortion and their insistence that not only women get pregnant, Peter. Well, how does that work? Oh, women transitioning to being men also get pregnant. And so it's this emperor's new clothes situation where we all have to agree with them that, yep, men can get pregnant, you know, as a starting point in the conversation.
Yeah.
And they are, this is a really important part of what Planned Parenthood is doing, is to, you know, advocate for gender transitions. And on their page for from Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, the header is gender and abortion. And it says most of the available statistics about abortion refer exclusively to women who are not the only people who have abortions. It says Planned Parenthood is committed to amplifying the voices of trans masculine and non-binary folks who also need and deserve access to abortion care. Your voice is needed in the movement for reproductive health, and you are welcome in our health centers no matter what. And so there's the agenda. You know, they're going to push for a changing of the norms and destigmatizing all of it. And the reason it matters is, of course, because they receive $500 million in tax money every year as a, you know, as a national organization. And if that's not, if you know, and I really wish that we had better news about defunding that and having that dry up, but I think it's not likely as they continue to try to position themselves as a healthcare agency alone. Do they provide some healthcare services? Yes, of course they do. But is their political clout and their abortion business far ahead of their healthcare services in terms of their emphasis as well as their funding and their income streams? It's absolutely the case.
Okay, I'm so mindful that the biblical text calls us to discern the truth of things relative to the fruit that they bear. And you would think that when things are bearing fruit, that there is sort of a joy, a peace, a lack of ambiguity, there's clarity, there's a sense of wholeness of the heart. And in all of this conversation in our country that we're becoming more enlightened finally about gender and allowing people to choose and the transition and masculine people having babies, this doesn't seem to be terribly peaceful. I certainly see among my students that they're more confused than ever.
Oh my goodness. Of course it's confusing because it's discarded truth as its starting point. You know, and the women, if you watch the testimonies, those three that are posted on the Say Abortion page, you always run into this difficult or heartbreaking or emotional decision. I mean, the one woman who said, I will not apologize. This was absolutely the right thing. I was a minimum wage job. I had no prospects. It would have, you know, totally derailed my plans. I'm now an X-ray technologist and I have a stable life. And it was absolutely, it wasn't the right time for me to become a mother. And my heartbreaking decision, wait a minute, why was that heartbreaking? Because deep down we know there's another life involved. And we know that the competing rights of the child within the mother's womb and the mother, those competing rights have to find a way to be resolved without the death of one party or the other. But abortion on demand denies all of that. So when you have that lack of truth as the basis for what they're putting forward, only confusion can result.
It's the voice of Kim Cattola. We're talking about issues related to life and choice and abortion and so many of these really important conversations in our country. And Kim, when we come back in just a minute, let's change the conversation. You actually paid to get through the subscription firewall of the New York Times to read their 8-part series on pro-abortion. And I'd love to hear your reflections on that next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Don't live life in fear.
Welcome back to Bay Area Mornings. We're chatting with Kim Cotola this morning from Cradle My Heart about so many of the different dimensions of the abortion and pro-life, pro-choice conversation in our country. And Kim, you paid for maybe at least a bit of a subscription to the New York Times to check out their 8-part pro-abortion series. And certainly media these days is hardly known as a bastion of unbiased reporting, whether it be liberal or conservative. What did you find in the New York Times?
$2 I can never get back. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting effort on the part of the New York Times, which started this series December 28th and is not going to be complete until the 20th of this month. And it's called A Woman's Rights. And it's written by the editorial board without any further attribution. So we don't really know who wrote this. And they posted it under their opinion banner. Okay? So this is not, they're not held to any reporting standard in this, as far as I can see. And there are a lot of holes in the reporting. And right off the bat, there's a lot of, what do we want to say? Manipulation, I feel. They start with the story of a woman in Arkansas who had a stillbirth, and she did not know that she was pregnant, and she just wasn't feeling well, went to pour a bath for herself, and delivered twins with a pregnancy she was not aware that she was carrying, and in panic and in shock, she took the babies, put them in a purple suitcase, Peter, and dropped them by the side of the road. Now, someone found the suitcase, and they were able to trace it back to her, and she was charged with abuse of a corpse, which is really nothing to do with abortion or pregnancy. I mean, if, let's say, God forbid, your toddler dies, of course I'm sure you're panicked. But we would all know that the next thing to do would not be to put the body in a suitcase and drop it at the side of the road. The autopsy showed she did not abort these babies. There was no chemical found. It was pretty straightforward. And I think that, you know, we can all say, well, okay, I mean, this is a really tough case for her. However, I'm not sure a 3-year jail sentence is appropriate. It's a tough case, right?
Yeah.
But for them to roll this out as a story about abortion and to say that, you know, gee, the fact that fetuses are being granted more and more personhood rights means that people like her are going to be prosecuted more and more. But please, it's such a leap, and it's so disingenuous because the story is a tragedy all around and has nothing to do with abortion. When they get into the actual story of abortion, there's a quote in the piece that says this: after Roe, a handful of Republican strategists recognized in abortion an explosively emotional issue that could motivate evangelical voters and divide Democrats. In 1980, as Mr. Reagan ran for president, he raised the cause high and framed it in terms of rights for the unborn. Well, first of all, this is such a cynical stripping of the compassion of the defenders of the unborn, Peter. You and I don't care about life before birth. We're just looking for that explosive emotional issue that we can use to motivate people to get on our side, right?
Yeah.
And divide Democrats, right? Oh, excuse me, isn't that what you just did with that tragedy in Arkansas? Oh, my goodness. It goes on to say things like fear. This phrase really jumped out at me. They said that, you know, that pro-lifers are playing on the fear that the interests of a fetus could come in conflict with those of the woman carrying it. Right? So, wait a minute. The interests of a fetus could come in conflict with those of the woman carrying it? Wait, don't you mean the interests of a woman could come in conflict with the child she's carrying? I mean, don't each of us have an interest in our own lives? No, their very statement there says, it really suggests that we're just all property until our mothers deem elsewise. They use phrases like policing pregnancy, right, when they talk about what should happen to mothers who use drugs while pregnant. Policing pregnancy. Well, wait a minute, don't we also police parenting, like when the Department of Child Services has called in if a parent is neglectful or abusive? And certainly if a parent takes the life of a toddler? You know, it's just the whole thing is ideology meant to pander to women, of course, and the fear that the government is going to somehow limit a freedom that is devoid of responsibility. And it's shoddy journalism, very shoddy journalism.
And Kim, sorry to cut you off. We do have to run. We're just coming up against the top of the hour break here. But it sounds like I appreciate you entering into the article here and paying that $2 so that we don't have to on that. Appreciate your voice as always on the show, Kim, and look forward to the next time we have a chance to chat.
I hope so too, Peter.
We'll wrap up our show here, Faith Radio Mornings for the Day. Again, it was a great show having people like Ben Johnson, Carmen LeBurge, Jim Bilby, and, of course, the voice of Kim Cotola at the end here. You want to catch the entire show, it'll be up on our website, myfaithradio.com, here later this afternoon, and you can hear all of what the guests say. And until then, we will catch you tomorrow morning for Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.